You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's Friday, so it's brunch with Bernie. It's time for our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.senate.gov, his website. Of course, he represents the great state of Vermont, where Louise and I lived for about a decade, and we were pleased to have him then as our member of the House of Representatives. Bernie, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you with us. There's a lot going on, from health care to filibuster to student loans. Wow.
There is a lot. It's a busy week, and let me just rattle off some of what's going on. There will be likely, one never knows, but likely a vote on Tuesday regarding a change of Senate rules in an effort to end Republican obstructionism with regard to votes on presidential appointments. Right now, you have situations where Richard Cordray, who is the president's nominee to be heading the Consumer Finance Commission, which is it provides important protection to consumers who are getting ripped off by banks. His nomination has been held up forever. We have the issue of the entire National Labor Relations Board, which may soon not have a majority and not be able to function to protect workers whose rights on the job are being violated. We have Tom Perez, Obama's nominee, to be Secretary of Labor, being held up forever. Not to mention Gina McCarthy, who has been nominated to be head of the EPA. The issue here is that historically, with few exceptions, the assumption was that the president who won the election has a right to appoint his team, to bring cabinet people on board as quickly as possible to do their job. What Republicans have said, going way back to when Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, made the famous statement that his Republicans' main goal is to make sure that Obama is not a two-term president. They lost that particular effort, but they have persisted in trying to be as obstructionist as possible. Historically, people have had votes. Presidents have made nominations, and those nominees got a vote, and that was that. But Republicans now, for a variety of reasons, not because they think there are questions of moral turpitude or anything else, but simply because, among other things, they don't like the EPA. They don't want the Environmental Protection Agency to enforce the law against large companies who pollute. Well, that's one reason to stall off Gina McCarthy's nomination. You don't like the National Labor Relations Board because it gives workers protection as they try to form unions or work to prevent violations of labor law on the job. Well, let's not have a National Labor Relations Board. We don't like consumer protection. Let's not have a guy who's head of that agency. So what Reid, the majority leader, has finally said is enough is enough. The president is entitled to his nominees. We are going to change the rules so that if Republicans want a filibuster, it will only require 51 votes to overcome that filibuster rather than 60. Now, Tom, I was, as you may recall, a number of months ago, Democrats argued about filibuster, and a lot of us in the Senate who believed we should move to what is called a talking filibuster. Mm-hmm. And that means give the opposition all the time they need to make their case. But at the end of the day, we needed 51 votes. Reid and leadership rejected that idea. They came up with a kind of a weak approach that expedited the process, but went nowhere near as far as it should. I was the only person in the caucus as an independent Democratic caucus to vote against it, and I think the Democrats are now rethinking their approach. So that should come up for a vote, I think, on Tuesday. My own view remains that so long as the Republicans have, in a sense, broken the long tradition, the long, quote-unquote, gentleman's agreement, which has always stated that filibusters should be done sparingly, that you don't require 60 votes unless it is rather something extraordinary, that in general pieces of legislation should be voted upon with 51 votes winning, majority winning. And since the Republicans have essentially discarded that unwritten rule that has led for, had existed for so long. I think it's time for the Democrats to put in writing language which says, you know what, majority rules. You can have as much time as you want to argue your case, but at the end of the day, this country faces so many serious problems that we need the Senate to start functioning and pass legislation which protects working people, that we've got to end this obstructionism. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, and that's what will happen on Tuesday. The other issue that got a lot of attention this week is the issue of student loans. We have a real crisis in this country with lower-income and middle-class families having a difficult time affording to send their kids to college. Of course, the college is soaring. We now have a situation where student debt is actually even higher in this country at $1.1 trillion than credit card debt. And kids, you have hundreds of thousands of young people who are quite able to handle a college workload but are choosing not to go to college because they don't want to come out of school $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 in debt. And that is a real tragedy, not only for those young people, their families, but for the country as well. We lose all of that intellectual capital because these kids can no longer afford to go to college because the costs are too high. Early in the week, we voted to maintain what's called the Stafford Subsidized Loan, which goes out to the lowest income families at 3.4%. We won that vote with 51%, but Republicans filibustered. We needed 60 votes, didn't carry. There's another effort on the way, which I have serious concerns about, because it's tied to a 10-year interest rates for students will be, and their families will be tied to a 10-year Treasury note, which means that as interest rates go up, as most economists expect they will, the student interest rates on student loans will also go up. There will be a cap on those loans under that legislation at some 8.2%. But some of the grad student loans may go higher, and the parent loan program may go higher up to 9.7%. So bottom line here, I think that we should, as a nation, make affordable college a priority. I think we should not allow interest rates to go to a level which is unsustainable for many working class families. So I'm not sympathetic to this variable, to this interest rates tied to a 10-year Treasury note, which means that they will go up and up and up, and most likely. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of the issues that are out there. A third issue has to do with the majority, the chairman and ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, Max Baucus, is the chairman of that committee, asking for proposals regarding tax policy in the United States. My fear there is that the ranking member, Orrin Hatch, and the chairman, Max Baucus, are not particularly strong on these issues in terms of standing up to corporate America. So we have a situation now where one out of four major corporations is paying nothing in taxes. Corporate tax rates at 12% are much lower than they have been in recent years, and I do not want to see these guys give more tax breaks to corporations that today are enjoying record-breaking profits. So that's a whole other area of discussion.
And an important one. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Bernie taking your calls. And be sure to check out his website over at sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
On Bernie's website, you can both sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz. Plus, you can see every day, every few hours, they update the information on there. It's a great news source. Check it out. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Jason in Washington, D.C., listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, I'm a big one in terms of corporate governance, and what I've been disturbed about is the Obama administration, the Justice Department's been in charge for a very long period of time, and I've been seeing companies like HSBC that has been charged with laundering drug money and dealing with rogue nations get fines, but nobody goes to jail. Glaxo, $3 billion fine, nobody goes to jail. Wells Fargo, Wachovia, laundering money again, fines, nobody goes to jail. But you steal an apple from a corner, and you're going to get ramrodded. So somehow these corporations have this insulation. What are we going to do? And it's not about, well, we need to vote. Obama's in power. He's in charge of the Justice Department. Why is there not people going to jail?
Well, Jason, thank you for giving my speech that I have given on a couple of occasions on the floor of the Senate. Let me be very frank with you. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, a couple of months ago, he kind of backpedaled from it a little bit. But this is what he said. He was up before some committee in the Senate, and somebody asked him a question. He said, well, in so many words, I'm not quoting him exactly, obviously. He said, look, if we prosecute these large, huge financial institutions, it will bring instability to these banks, which could have national economic implications and even international, global economic implications. In other words, to rephrase what Holder said, these guys are not only too big to fail, they are too big to jail. So, Jason, let me give you the blunt answer. The reason these guys are not prosecuted or jailed is they are too powerful. And let me tell you what I expect you already know. There is, at the very least, a double standard of justice in this country. If you're a working person, if you're a kid, if you break the law and you don't have a lot of money, you can go to jail. But if you are a major player in a huge financial institution, you don't go to jail. That's where we are in America. And frankly, it doesn't matter whether it's a Republican running the White House or a Democrat running the White House. Wall Street, you know, there's often a lot of discussion about how Congress should regulate Wall Street, Dodd-Frank, etc. The reality, as I've mentioned on this show a million times, Wall Street regulates the Congress. The Congress does not regulate Wall Street. What's the answer to that? There is no answer for tomorrow. The answer is that you need a strong, progressive, grassroots movement, which, among many other things in terms of Wall Street, breaks up these handful of huge financial institutions, which today are bigger than they were before they were, quote-unquote, too big to fail, where you have six financial institutions today that have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the gross domestic product of the United States of America, over $9 trillion controlled by six financial institutions. So if anyone thinks that the United States Congress regulates these guys, you got it backwards. They have the ability politically, through campaign contributions, through lobbyists, through all of their influence, to have a huge impact on what Congress does and does not do. Jason, that is the honest answer to your question.
Tony, in Midlothian, Virginia, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hello, how you doing, Senator?
Good.
I was just wondering, my wife works with the Department of the Army, and she's being furloughed every Friday, you know, so she's losing 20% of her paycheck, which is a nice little chunk. So I was just wondering, are you guys going to start talking again about the sequester?
Thank you, Tony. And tell your wife we appreciate her service. And let me answer your question. I agree with the sentiment of your question, except for one phrase. It's you guys. And very often, Tom, what happens is people get so disgusted with what goes on in Washington as they kind of lump everybody together, which really benefits right-wing Republicans. So here's the story. Sequestration, which is a 2% cut across the board, and in the military, they are dealing with that cut by putting on furlough some of their people. Other places, in terms of the Older Americans Act, for example, 2% cut means that frail, hungry, elderly people may not be getting a Meals on Wheels. It means that if you are a working-class person and your kid is in Head Start, you may not be able to have your kid in Head Start. It means that if you need affordable housing, you may not be able to get affordable housing. That's what sequestration is about. Now, sequestration came about because Congress could not reach an agreement on a budget. That's basically what it's about. I voted for, as a member of the Budget Committee, a strong budget which would have prevented sequestration. And it does that by saying, yeah, we're going to deal with deficit reduction, but you're going to deal with that not just by cutting Medicare and Medicaid and every other program, nutrition programs, housing programs, but by asking large corporations, one out of four of which pay nothing in taxes today, to start paying something in taxes. And that's where the rubber hit the road. Our Republican friends who control the House say, no, no, no. The only way we want to do deficit reduction, the only way we will do it is by cutting, cutting, cutting. We don't want billionaires in this country to pay a nickel more in taxes. We don't want major corporations, General Electric, Bank of America, many others, making billions of profits who in any given year might pay zero in federal income taxes. They don't want to ask those guys to pay. That's where we are at. That's why sequestration took place. So we are working hard trying to get a budget. I will tell you that the budget passed the Senate a number of months ago. I think it was a 50-49 vote. And every day, the chair of the Budget Committee, Patty Murray of Washington, is trying to get the budget to go into conference committee. Republicans are objecting to that. So that's kind of where we are right now. And I'm sorry to say that, Tony, but that's the reality of where we are.
So right now it's the Republicans in the House of Representatives, basically, that are blocking it.
Republicans in the Senate and in the House.
And in the Senate. Oh, my. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting where you can ask questions of a United States senator. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back in just a minute with more of your questions for Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't forget, we have a Tom Hartman app over at the App Store. You get Sue's Daily List, you get our newsletter, you get our blog, you get all kinds of cool stuff. It's free. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the True People's Media. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your questions. And Jelena in Hazel Park, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish TV satellite network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. I have a question about the coming TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and what if the people, if anything, can do anything about this, or at least be educated about it to hold our leaders accountable.
Thank you, Jelena, for that important question. Since the Reagan era, there have been a number of free trade agreements that have been passed by Congress. Perhaps the best known is NAFTA, and you have CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. You have the Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, a huge trade agreement. There are a number of other trade agreements, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will include Vietnam and a number of other Asian countries. I think the American people understand that, by and large, the so-called free trade agreements pushed by corporate America have worked to benefit large multinational corporations, but have been disastrous for working families. When you look at the economy right now, Galena, and you see a middle class in rapid decline, a median family income some $5,000 a year below where it was back in 1999, real unemployment close to 14%, young people unable to find any type of work. When you look at that, one of the reasons for the decline of the middle class has been the collapse of manufacturing in the United States. In the last 10 years, we have lost close to 60,000 factories, not all of them having to do with trade or companies moving to China or Mexico or elsewhere. Some of that dealing with automation and companies just go out of business. But a lot of it having to do with the fact that corporations in this country prefer to hire people abroad at low wages than hire Americans at a living wage. That's just the simple reality. They don't want to obey environmental laws. They don't want to deal with unions. They don't want to provide health care. So I think any objective analysis of our past trade policies, which force American workers to compete against people in Vietnam, for example, I suspect there are people working there making $25, $50 a week. And I think that's wrong. So what we need to do is to end the so-called unfettered free trade programs and establish trade programs which are designed to protect working families, not just multinational corporations. So I say that to you, Galina, as somebody who has never voted for any of these trade agreements, and I think those votes were, from a historical perspective, absolutely correct. And I have similar misgivings about the TPP.
Harry in Seattle, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Senator, in light of the lies that the Republicans told about the Affordable Care Act, what lies do you predict they will tell in opposition to Senator Warren's bill to restore the law, the rule of law, to the banking industry?
The Glass-Steagall repeat.
Right.
Yep.
Well, some of us for a number of years, well, let me retreat a little bit here and give you my sense of what goes on. First of all, I do not believe that we're going to ever be able to restore the middle class in this country, ever create the kind of vibrant economy we need, unless we deal with Wall Street. Wall Street is just so powerful. They are so large. They are involved in such reckless and speculative activity that they are an absolute detriment to our economy. As I mentioned earlier, all of these banks that were bailed out in 2008, 2009, because they were too big to fail, are actually larger today, and they continue along their speculative efforts. The function of Wall Street is not to provide capital to the productive economy, i.e. to businesses, large and small, who actually produce products or provide services. Wall Street, to a significant degree, has become a gambling institution through very complicated financial mechanisms and it is able to make huge sums of money for itself. So obviously I support the effort to restore Glass-Steagall, but I think we've got to go even further than that. Now you say, what lies will they say? Well, I think the lies will be that banks, financial institutions, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, etc., cannot be competitive in the global economy unless they continue to be very, very large and are able to provide all of the services they do. There are a number of studies which suggest that the opposite is actually true, that their huge size makes them in many ways inefficient. But the bottom line here is that economically, when you have six financial institutions having assets equivalent to 2/3 of the GDP of America, that gives us so much economic power, so much political power, that if that continues to stand, I worry very much about the future economic life of this country. So, kind of that's what they will tell us, is that being big, being huge is necessary in the global economy. Tell us about all the wonderful things that they do. I don't suspect the American people will believe much of that.
Greg in Youngwood, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Okay. I think it's really sad because we have a U.S. senator, and the best we can do is, they're too big to jail, so that's okay, and we're going to accept that. I mean, it's pathetic, you know, come to think of it, because we need to cut term limits for one thing, because people who are senators and congressmen won't do anything because it's tied to their job. And we can't accept this in America, because they tell us anything and we accept it. And as a U.S. senator, we got to...
Greg, do you have a question?
Proactive. Yeah, I do. I do have a question, sir. Why are U.S. senators so weak and they do accept this?
Good question, Greg. And the answer is, I don't agree with you, by the way, about term limits making the situation better. What you need is campaign finance reform. Greg, the answer is really not complicated. Just imagine if you were to run for the United States Senate from Pennsylvania, you'd probably have to raise $25, $30, $40 million. Where do you think you're going to get most of your money from? Where do you think your money is going to come from for you to win, for you to put those 30-second ads up on television that candidates often do? The reality is that especially since Citizens United, which was that disastrous Supreme Court decision, candidates have to raise huge sums of money. And the way they get their money is from wealthy individuals and large corporations. That's the reality. Unless you deal with that reality of a Congress and governors, et cetera, dependent upon big money, you're not going to have state legislatures or the U.S. House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate standing up and fighting for ordinary people. That is the reality. So you need campaign finance reform. In my view, you need public funding of elections. But, Greg, don't get distracted by things like term limits. So if you had term limits, who do you think would be running the Senate? The bureaucracy and the lobbyists would have even more power. The essential issue is, do we elect people who are going to represent working families, or do you elect people who are going to represent corporate America? And so long as candidates are dependent upon big money to get elected, that's who they're going to represent.
Steve, in Miami Beach, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Senator, I have a lot of respect for you. I want to preface my comments with that. But beyond that, I wonder at what point do you feel enough frustration that you'll leave the Senate and actually participate in a progressive grassroots movement that may actually get some of these things pushed forward. And I think Thomas said before that progressive movements are not one from within the system. They're actually led from without the system.
Well, Steve, you make a, thank you for the question. I am very proud to be, you know, Vermont's senator. It's a position I never believed that somebody with my views would have. And I'm going to do my best to represent Vermont and working people around the country. Your point about the need for a strong national progressive movement is absolutely correct. We're going to need, we're going to need, it's not just a leader that we need, Steve. We need people all over this country prepared to get their hands dirty, running for the school board, running for the city council, running for the legislature, running for governor, getting the word out to other people in the middle class and the working class that we better be involved in politics. I just saw a piece today Charles Koch of the Koch brothers is now busy spending hundreds of thousands of dollars already on TV and media ads. The billionaires are at war with working families, and working families have got to fight back. So it's not a question of me, Steve, being a leader of that movement. It's a question of thousands of people all over this country coming together and understanding their common interests. Understanding that if you are a federal worker or a state employee, or you work in the private sector, or if your mom has Social Security, your dad has Medicare, we're all in this together. We better stand together.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie in just a moment. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S, .senate.gov.gov. You'll find a treasure trove of great information.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Plus, you can sign up for Bernie's newsletter, the Bernie Buzz. It'll keep you up to date on what's going on in the Senate, politics in general, and around the country. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Jim in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, and it's an honor for me to speak to both of you.
Thank you.
My question is what are the benefits if the Koch brothers, GE, all of the corporations eventually end up getting what they want out of the workers, out of the United States, out of the economy? Where is the benefit for them in the long run? I don't understand.
Okay. Jim, thanks for that question. You know, Tom, one of the things that's frustrating is, you know, as a senator, I see a million issues. And the American people see a million issues. There's so many things that are happening, and so many of them are important. And every issue is important to somebody out there. But there are some profound issues, some issues that are just much, much more important than anything else. And I think Jim began to touch on that issue. And that is that what is going on right now in America is you have folks like the Koch brothers and others, people of the billionaire class, who are literally at war with working families. I just saw something up on a website which implied that one of the Koch brothers, at least, believes that we should do away with the minimum wage, that the existence of the minimum wage is an impediment to prosperity in America. And now you have, by the way, in Washington, I can tell you that the debate is not whether we raise the minimum wage. I believe in substantially increasing the minimum wage. Vermont has one of the highest minimum wages in the country. The question among our Republican friends is whether or not the minimum wage should exist at all. And apparently at least one of the Koch brothers, and I can tell you many United States senators, now believe that we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage. And for them, what freedom is about is that if you are struggling in a high unemployment area and you are prepared to work for $3 an hour and an employer is prepared to pay you $3 an hour, that's freedom. That's freedom. We've gotten the government out of our lives. We've gotten rid of that terrible minimum wage. These same guys, there was a group of folks at the Business Roundtable. The Business Roundtable, ladies and gentlemen, is the organization representing the CEOs of every major corporation in America. And they came to Washington, Wall Street, all these guys came to Washington. They said, we think we should raise the retirement age for Social Security to 70 years of age, Medicare eligibility to 70 years of age. These are guys, all multimillionaires, all having fantastic health care, all having wonderful retirement programs, telling Congress that we should raise the raise the retirement age for Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what Jim asked is, what do these guys want? This is what they want. They want to undo every single piece of legislation, do away with the ability of workers to form unions. Either cut back or even undo, do away with Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Some of these guys believe Social Security is unconstitutional. Federal government should not be involved at all in Medicare and Medicaid. Just yesterday, House of Representatives passed for the first time in 30 years, as I understand it, a farm bill that did not include food stamps. You got one out of five kids in this country who are hungry. Elderly people don't have enough to eat, and they did not include food stamps in their farm bill. So these guys want to bring us back to the 1920s when workers had no Social Security, there was no health care people, no right to form unions, no security, and bring us back to a time, and we are moving in that direction, where the billionaire class, the top 1%, controls the economic and political life of this country. That is what they want. And what they're trying to do now is engaging in a race to the bottom. The same guy, I think it's Charles Koch, was comparing American workers. We're not doing so bad compared to sub-Sahara Africa. You're doing really well compared to desperate third world countries. What are you complaining about in America? And that is now the line of some of these Tea Party Republicans, that we are being now compared not to Finland, not to Denmark, not to first world countries, but to people in the third or fourth world. So there is a war, Jim, against working families. Apparently, the Koch brothers were worth, $40 billion. Don't think that that's enough. They need more. General Electric, which doesn't pay on any given year anything in federal income taxes, that's not good enough for them. And on it goes. So that's what it's about. These guys want more power. They want more wealth. And they are prepared to use their wealth and power to gain even more.
Bernie, we have just 2 minutes to the end of the hour.
Let's take one more, see if we can.
Okay,
we
take a call here.
I won't rant quite as long.
Okay. James in Leslie, Arkansas, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. A quick one, please, James.
Oh, yes. My goodness, Senator Sanders, you just bestowed it. You just capitalized and increased my question to you. And it concerns with a Senator Elizabeth Warren's 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act. I'm seeing an attack on credit unions again by the large banks.
Yes.
That occurred back in the 80s. In your ramblings in through Senate and perhaps visiting with Senator Warren, have you come across this, that they are going back into the credit unions?
Absolutely.
At lower rates? Thank you.
Yeah, they are, of course. I mean, here's an example. We have these huge banks which were bailed out by the American people. They are very, very worried that credit unions that are nonprofit institutions pay nothing in federal taxes. Very worried about that. So they want to impose, have the credit unions, which are nonprofits, which share their profits with their members, which often have lower rates than banks, they want them to pay taxes. So, yes, these large banks will continue their effort to try to impede the growth of credit unions, absolutely.
And thus, now is a great time to move your money into a credit union.
And, you know, a lot of people are. You talk to the credit unions now, and they are doing, by and large, pretty well.
Yeah.
And they are expanding, and they should, because often they provide lower interest rates, and they are not paying their CEOs exorbitant salaries.
Yep.
And they're paying more attention to the people in their community.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thank you so much for being with us again this week.
Thank you. Take care.
It's always an honor to have you. We will be back with more Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program in this Anything Goes summer. Quite a day. There's a lot of news. By the way, they just wrapped up the George Zimmerman trial. I'll tell you all about that, too. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. While I was spending the morning going through the news of the day, reading all the various websites, just, you know, basically getting ready, show prep. We had our meeting for the TV show, meeting for the radio show with all the staff and whatnot. Throughout that, I was watching the defense summarize their case in the George Zimmerman trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin. And then watched the prosecution summarize their case, and then came down here to the radio studio and listened to the judge give her instructions to the jury. I found it all fascinating and have my own opinions about it, but I wanted to check in with Debbie Hines. She is both a trial lawyer and a former prosecutor and a legal political commentator. She writes over at LegalSpeaks.com, and Debbie has just some of the greatest insights. Debbie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Well, I'm curious what your take was on what happened this morning.
Well, I think that starting with the defense, I think they did a really good job of what they had to do. But again, their job was really an easier job in this case, because it is, regardless of what the prosecution may say, it is still a circumstantial case for the prosecution. Now, today there was the final close, because the state has the burden of proof. It's always sandwiched. So the state starts the closing arguments, the defense gives their closing, and it ends with the rebuttal closing. And if they can get a conviction, it will be truly because John Guy just made it plain, clear, simple. It's not that complicated.
Yeah, my takeaway was basically, kid walking home from the store, he's perfectly legal, he's not doing anything wrong, weird guy chases him with a gun in his belt, and the kid ends up dead. And isn't this every child's nightmare, that some strange,
yeah,
large older man is going to chase him down and shoot him? And I don't see how there can be anything other than a conviction, at least for manslaughter. That's my take on this. But how do you think this is going to play out?
Well, you know, it plays out according to the lens of the six women jurors that are hearing the case. So how it plays out with my lens and your camera lens is not the lens that it's being presented before. And so even with that, I still think that even though John Guy gave from a lawyer's perspective, regardless of what side you're on, his closing was brilliant. It was very, very stellar. But with those particular women that are on that jury, it may not be enough. it just may not be enough. I mean, Seminole County is still a conservative demographically county, so there are made up of people who are more conservative, who are more likely than not Republican, although we don't know their political affiliation, but the county is majority Republican. And so it's not that they're going to read it through the lens that I may be reading it through and that you may be reading it through.
Now, one of the objections that I had to the prosecution's summation was he said this is not about race. And then, you know, he said if it had been 27-year-old, he sort of reversed the roles, but I thought he did a very clumsy job of that. A, B, I think saying to a jury that has no African Americans on it, it's not about race, is like almost a way of saying, you know, vote your prejudice. And C, it seems to me like there's a lot of race in this thing. It's saturated in race. That I've said this to you before. In my opinion, If the older person with the gun who killed the young kid had been black and the young kid had been white, we wouldn't even be having the trial. There would be a plea bargain about is it first or second degree or something like that.
It's interesting that your take on that part of the closing argument, because from my vantage point, mm-hmm. I thought that was the best part of the
really?
Closing. Argument.
Okay, absolutely. Well, I defer to your superior observation on these things.
It's through my lens, and I thought it was the best part of the closing argument because he was saying it the way he has to say it again to those white conservative women jurors.
Right.
He couldn't say it the way I would want to say it or the way I may have written it out on my blog. He was saying that it's not about race. And the way you'll know it's not about race is if you would give the same verdict if it was 17-year-old Trayvon Martin riding in the car and 20-some-year-old George Zimmerman ends up getting killed. And that's how I think he had to play it with that jury.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll see how it plays out. That makes perfect sense to me, too. Okay. Do you disagree with my assertion that there is a racial component to this?
Oh, it's absolutely about race. But I mean, there were Tom. I followed the case from the beginning with the jury selection. There were blacks that didn't end up on the jury that said it wasn't about race. And again, like I said, this case is not playing out in Chicago or Washington D.C. or New York or or Baltimore. It's playing out in Sanford, Florida, and it's playing out before the people that live there.
Yeah, but it seemed to me that in George Zimmerman's mind, it was all about race, and therefore it's about race.
Absolutely. And we're saying the same thing. Mm. We're saying, I mean, I'm agreeing it is 100% about race. That's what I've always said. It's about race, and this jury's verdict will speak volumes about race in America. But you couldn't say that to that jury because that jury has blindfolds on when it comes to race.
Right.
The people there had blindfolds, a lot of the jurors that were black as well as, you know, the white jurors.
Yeah, and even if they don't, they're supposed to. I mean, they're supposed to be doing this on its merits, not on the, you know, if George Zimmerman's intent had a racial motivation, that was still a malicious motivation, and they should be looking at the malice part of it, not the racial part of it. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, the judge, here's the problem. The judge early on, before openings, had said that they could not say it was racially profiling. So right. She took the race out of it there.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying, the way John Guy got it in was the way he could get it in.
Right. In fact, he referred to the defense using the word. He said, we haven't talked about this. The defense has. That's an important point. How long do you expect? First of all, is the jury going to deliberate over the weekend? And secondly, how long do you figure it's going to take?
It's really no way to know. I mean, everybody that tries to second-guess juries, there's no way to know. There's some cases that have been big cases that have been, I'm wondering what is taking them 20 days to come back with a verdict, and that was the case of the Baltimore mayor where the jury was out almost as long as the case took. It's really no way to know. I mean, I will say this. I feel that in this case, if the jury comes back tonight, it's not guilty on all counts.
Really? Wow.
Yes, I mean, a quick verdict in a case like this, I don't think that the case is overwhelmingly on the side of the state.
Right.
And I think that if they come back very quickly, then it's going to be a not guilty verdict on both of the counts. I think that in this type of case, and it varies, I mean, there may be some people that say differently according to rules, but it's in this type of case where the victim is African American, and you're basically looking at the flip of things.
Right.
That if they're out a long time, I really feel that someone will be in there fighting for the prosecution to get that conviction.
Right. So the perpetrator's not African American. Nobody's on the jury is African American. The victim is, therefore, that's how these kind of things go if
right.
they go fast. Okay.
And there may be one woman that is African American. I mean, even today, they're still reporting that, I think it's B36. There's one juror that they're reporting as she's either, black or Hispanic. So they don't really know. There could be one black juror.
Huh. Interesting. And one juror can swing a jury.
Absolutely.
It's
and I think John Guy gave, that's why I liked his rebuttal close. I think he gave the ammunition to swing the jury if there is at least one.
Very interesting. Well, I want to have another conversation with you, Debbie, when this thing comes back, if that's all right with you.
Yes, absolutely,
great.
Tom.
Thank you. I really appreciate your insights and your thoughts. It's great to have somebody who knows what they're talking about that I can bounce this stuff off of. Debbie Hines, she writes over at LegalSpeaks.com. Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
Have a great weekend. We'll be
you
right
too.
Back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Debbie writes at LegalSpeaks, with an S at the end, .com. Check it out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You will recall Senator Sanders, in the first hour of the program, mentioned how horrified he was that the House of Representatives split the farm bill in half so that they could pass the welfare stuff for the big ag on the one hand, my phrase, not his, and ignore the food stamps for average working people. So when this happened in the House of Representatives, a group of Democrats tried to stand up and get their objection to that on the record so that weeks, months, years, decades, centuries in the future, people could look back on this moment in time and know where the Democrats stood and why. Now, the problem is if you say, I would like permission to revise and extend my remarks, which is a fancy way of saying, I want to put something on the record. I want it to be written down in the congressional record where it's part of the permanent written record of the Congress. I'd like to extend and revise my remarks. If somebody says, I object, then unless you can overcome that objection or a vote is held to overcome the objection, basically it gets struck from the record. And, of course, the Republicans control the House, so if a Republican is objecting, there's not going to be a vote held to overrule or override that objection. And so just listen to this. This starts out with Congressman Jim McGovern, who is the Democratic representative from Massachusetts. He's given, I believe it's a 15-minute period to speak. And so what he does is he uses his time by tossing it out to other members of the House of Representatives so that they can put their remarks on the record. And so you'll hear him refer it to one person and then refer it to another person and then refer it to another person. And finally, he gets what the Republicans are doing. And by the way, the objection every single time is Louie Gohmert, the Republican from Texas. And that Louie Gohmert keeps objecting to this. But just now that you understand how it works and what's going on, listen to the Republicans preventing the Democrats from even getting onto the record the fact that they object to the fact that the Republicans have stripped the food stamps out of the farm bill. Here it is.
Gentleman from Massachusetts, recognized.
I yield to the gentlelady from Oregon, Ms. Bonamici, for a unanimous consent request.
Gentlelady is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it will increase hunger in America.
Objection. There is objection.
Mr. Speaker, I yield to the my good friend, the gentleman from Massachusetts, Mr. Kennedy, for a unanimous consent request.
Gentleman's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it takes food nutrition away from working families. Thank you.
Is there objection? There is objection.
And again, another objection. It's struck from the record.
The gentleman from Massachusetts will state his point of parliamentary.
Am I understanding the gentleman's objection correctly that what he is doing is not even giving members on our side the courtesy of inserting their statement in the record?
Basically, yes. That's what's going on.
State a proper point of parliamentary inquiry.
I'm trying to understand what the objection means that the gentleman from Texas. I mean, does that mean that the gentleman from Massachusetts' statement that he just made will not appear in the record?
The objection was to the unanimous consent request.
In other words, yes, it will not appear in the record.
Mr. Speaker, at this point I'd like to yield to the gentlelady from New York, my good friend Ms. Lowy, for a unanimous consent request.
The gentlelady from New York is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in strong opposition to the Farm Bill rule and the underlying bill because it hurts the working poor and takes food and nutrition from hardworking families.
There you go. And it goes on like this for Well, there's 8 or 9 minutes of it over at rawstory.com. You can watch it. It's a clip from C-SPAN. And I don't know how long the actual thing went on because I saw the web version of it. I didn't watch it in real time on C-SPAN. But this is how callous these Republicans are and how much they want to cover their tracks. I mean, you would think that they would at least have the courage to do what Charles Koch did. You may disagree with Charles Koch. That, hey, isn't it a wonderful thing? If you make over $34,000, you're in the top 1% of the world. You should be happy you're so much better off than Bangladesh. I mean, Charles Koch is spending a couple $100,000 of his own money to put that ad on TV. He goes and he does an interview with the Kansas City newspaper and says, yeah, there shouldn't be a minimum wage. And no, there should be no impediment to employer hiring anybody from anywhere in the world and paying them whatever they damn well please. These are my characterizations of his remarks, not verbatim of his remarks, but you can read his remarks. It's no secret. I mean, essentially, this is what he's saying. He has the courage of his convictions. He's willing to say it on the record. But Louis Gohmert and the Republicans in the House of Representatives are cowards. When the Democrats stand up and say, oh, yeah, okay, you're going to split off the food stamp part so we don't get to vote on that. In other words, it doesn't get funded. Instead, we're just going to vote on and fund the part that helps out Monsanto. That's cowardly. It's going to lead to hunger in America, as Congressman Kennedy said. It's going to hurt working families, as the Congresswoman from Oregon said. And Louis Gohmert stands up and goes, I object. And so it gets stricken from the record. Not only are these people heartless, not only are they just totally in the bag for the billionaires and the transnational corporations, and in this case the big ag companies, and trashing the American middle class and the working people and the poor people, the working poor of this country, and the genuinely poor. The impoverished, the disabled. Not only are they trashing them, but they're such cowards that they're doing everything they can to prevent the Democrats who stand up to speak in opposition to this kind of behavior from even having their remarks on the record. And you can look back at the congressional record in the 1830s, and you can see when John Quincy Adams was fighting against slavery, and after he became president, he went back and ran for the House of Representatives. And he would get up, stand up and give speeches, and he would read them into the record. He'd submit them to the record. They're on the record. You can look back 150 years and see what they said. But this won't be on the record.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Louis Gohmert and the Republican cowards are preventing the Democratic objections from even being on the record. Now, this is interesting. The all-male Iowa Supreme Court just ruled that it is not gender discrimination for an employer to fire a woman because she is too attractive. Their phrase, too attractive. Very strange. This was a dentist whose wife apparently objected to an employee's appearance. Oh, man. If we, you know, it's just, it's like strange times we live in. I don't know how to put it beyond that. Anyhow, Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to make banking boring again. You may have already heard this, but just a real quick recap. John McCain and Maria Cantwell, Republican Democrat, Maria Cantwell from the Democrat from Washington State, John McCain, the Republican from anywhere there's a camera, have joined up to with Elizabeth Warren to introduce the Glass-Steagall Act of 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, because Mr. Glass and Mr. Steagall are long dead. But hey, you know, the name still works, and I think that's just a marvelous thing. So, but it's anything goes Friday. So let me toss it out to you. I will continue throughout the hours bringing you up to date on the news of the day as it goes along. Right now, Jack in Norman, Oklahoma, you had some thoughts on the Zimmerman trial?
Yes, Tom. I have a kind of a technical question. I was hoping either you or some of your viewers could call in and help me. Zimmerman was asserting an affirmative defense. An affirmative defense is, you know, the defendant says, yeah, I did it, but I was justified. In this case, he said, I had to shoot the kid because he was threatening to kill me.
Right. But not necessarily kill. The Florida law says either kill, that Zimmerman had to, in his mind, not necessarily in reality, in his mind, believe that he was at risk of death or grave or serious bodily injury. One of those words, right. One of those adjectives that, yeah, go ahead.
Right. But ordinarily, when you assert an affirmative defense, the burden of proof shifts. That is, if the state accuses me of something, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that I did it.
Right.
But if I assert, yeah, I did it, but an affirmative defense, now the burden shifts to me, and I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that I was in danger and I was trying to protect myself. And
okay.
None of this was
Shana,
ever...
Shana, you know this stuff?
Pardon me?
Yeah. Hang on just a second. Can you put yourself on the air? Okay. I'm Jack, I'm talking to Shane O'Farnan here, our associate producer who is...
He has it almost...
Who is a law school graduate and knows this stuff.
Almost all the way there, because, yes, the burden of proof does shift on affirmative defenses, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't believe. I think
it becomes
preponderance
of the evidence,
I believe.
Okay. All right. And then, of course, it would vary from state to state, would it not? I mean, this is murder laws or state laws.
They are state laws, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. But in general, principle. Does that make sense, Jack?
Well, if Florida law is different, I don't know if Florida law is different, but I thought...
So apparently, you know, yes, the burden has shifted to George Zimmerman to prove that he was afraid and that he had been injured. But I think that, you know, it doesn't, you know, preponderance of the evidence, you know, all he has to do is convince the jury that he was sufficiently injured that put him in fear of his life. And then it becomes relatively subjective. You know, was he seriously in fear for his life? And B, did he really have to shoot the kid in order to overcome that fear for his life or a fear of grave bodily injury? You know, in my opinion, you know, you should be, if you've got a gun, you should be able to pull a gun out and say stop, and the other person would stop. Right? You know, the idea that he had to shoot him just goes way beyond the pale in my mind. But
I didn't hear anything during the trial of anybody saying that there was any burden on him to show that he was afraid or that he had to defend himself.
Yeah.
That is, the pundits on MSNBC all said that he didn't have to prove anything. And I think, in fact, that some of the lawyers said that during their argument, that Zimmerman didn't have to prove anything.
Right.
And
the burden was on the state.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, Jack. And yeah, in the summation, I got that. Shano, you want to jump in here again? You found something?
Well, it's not a matter of finding something. If the state doesn't prove its the basic case, then George Zimmerman doesn't have to prove anything. If the jury decides that, yeah, we're going to find him guilty, then the burden does shift. Does that make sense? So the basic burden is on the state.
Right,
but the self-defense part is on him. But if the state doesn't even get to the point to mount their burden,
right,
then it never shifts to him at all.
Okay.
It's a whole course on it called presumptions. It can be somewhat difficult.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay. Jack, thank you for the call. Maybe we can check in with Debbie Hines on this again, too, because she knows the specifics both of this case and Florida law as well. Larry, but thanks for the call, Jack, and maybe somebody will call in with more specific information on that or not. Larry from Berkeley, California. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for using our Tom Hartman app.
Yes, very, very much. I called in during Bernie, but I'm talking with you now.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to ask a senator to do was to support an amendment that was made to the Code of Federal Regulations. The Department of Labor is trying to get the state of California to pay overtime for in-home supportive service workers. Mm-hmm. In-home supportive service workers provide caregiver assistance for people that want to remain in their homes. It used to be called tenant care.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than live in institutions, if they're people with disabilities, such as myself.
Right, what some people would call home health care nurses or that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And the problem isn't with my caregiver getting overtime as such. I want my caregiver to get overtime because my caregiver works really, really hard for me. She's been with me for many years. It's very difficult to keep a caregiver, especially at the wage levels that the state pays.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that I live in California. And I also live in Alameda County, which is a state that pays one of the highest wages of any of the counties in California. But a lot of counties only pay like $8 an hour. If I'm in a rural county, the state pays less. But the problem is we feel that if the Department of Labor asks the state of California to pay overtime, the state of California will say no, and then they will say that my caregiver has to work a maximum of 40 hours a week. And that means that she will get less money, and she will work less hours, even if she wishes to work.
I get the conundrum, Larry. What is your call for action, or why are you calling and telling me about this?
All right, thank you, Tom. Senator Yohannes from, I guess he's from Nevada,
mm-hmm.
has asked for an amendment to the Code of Federal Regulations, trying to make sure that the Department of Labor won't place these restrictions
right. You're asking people to support that legislative effort.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not because I'm against my caregiver getting overtime hours. I want my caregiver to get overtime hours.
Right.
But
you don't want her to get dialed back. No, I got it. Larry, thank you for the call, and I think you did a good job of laying it out. By the way, I talked to Louise during the break, and one of our callers a couple days ago, we were talking about Higgins, suggested turkey baby food with no salt in it as a no iodine alternative, and she got some in Higgins, just ate a whole jar of it. She said, thanks for the great advice. She also mentioned that her mother, my mother-in-law, Gwen, dog Jake just died. And Gwen, if you're listening or watching, I just want to let you know that my heart goes out to you, and our best thoughts and wishes and prayers are with you. It's a difficult time losing, a dog that has been a companion for well over a decade, for a long, long time. And, we're with you. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I was just wondering if you're kind of like a gambling man and looking to make a long-term investment, if you are.
I'm not.
I've been thinking about it.
What's your suggestion?
I've been thinking about it. With the GOP constantly running these votes in the House there to get rid of Obamacare,
right.
I've been thinking in about 10 years, assuming that there is no negative things taken away from Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
that the GOP is going to start taking credit for it.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. If it succeeds, they'll say they'll start calling it Romneycare and saying, no, we did this first in Massachusetts and, you know, quack, quack, quack. I would say if you want to make a bet on 10 years out, though, my bet would be that 10 years from now, we're going to have a national single-payer health care system that is administered state by state, just like Canada's, that it'll be the Saskatchewan situation all over again. Saskatchewan in Canada did a single-payer system. It was so successful that the other provinces of Canada all eventually, within a decade or so, imitated it. And now there's a national single-payer healthcare system administered by the individual provinces. Vermont is already three-quarters of the way down the road for doing this, and Obamacare will allow it to happen in the beginning of 2017, at the end of 2016. And I predict that 10 years from now, that's what we're going to have. There won't, you know, the insurance companies are just going to be offering high-end, rich people's
You're
insurance.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, I could be wrong, but, I actually feel quite safe making that assertion. I think America is getting more progressive. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.org. And I do not have Victoria on my board, so I can't put her on the air. If we can do that, it'll take just a second. We've got a person helping out with our calls and apparently doesn't quite yet know how to do that. Hang on just a second, Victoria, if you can hear me. And don't see her. No, I don't have her on the board. Oh, hang on just a second. There it is. Yeah, no name or anything, but it's on line 11, so that's got to be Victoria. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
Finally, technology. Mercury's retrograde, so that accounts for it all. What's going on today?
Oh, there's lots going on today. There's lots and lots going on today. Let's start with the inspiring.
Okay.
You will remember Malala Yousafzai, who was shot in the head last October by the Taliban, the children's rights activist.
The young woman.
She was 15, yes. She was 15. She turned 16 today. And she was at the UN. And she addressed a special session of the United Nations. It was dubbed Malala Day, and the usual ambassadors and dignitaries cleared out. More than 500 young people, all under 25, packed the session.
Wow.
The only adults, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and UN Special Envoy for Global Education, Gordon Brown.
Yeah, by adults, you mean people over 25.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
And this is great. I mean, we talk about the war on women here and the Republicans, you know, trying to deny women access to birth control and abortions and things like that. But there's a shooting war on women going on in some parts of the world.
There is. I mean, just a couple of examples, and I'll tell you some of the things she said. In southwestern Pakistan, a suicide bomber blew up a bus carrying university students and teachers, killing 14 women a few weeks ago. Militants then attacked a hospital treating the injured, killing two dozen more. In northeastern Nigeria, militants opened fire on students taking their exams at school, killing 9 of them. And just the day before, 13 students and teachers were killed when extremists attacked a boarding school.
And these are all female students?
I think most of them are female. Some of them may even be boys. I mean, the Taliban are going after all education at the moment.
Wow. Let's go right back to the 8th century.
This is quite extraordinary. She started her speech by saying, I don't know where to begin my speech. I don't know what people would be expecting me to say. She went on to say, I'm not against anyone, and neither am I here in terms of personal revenge. But she went on to say, the extremists are afraid of books and pens. The power of education frightens them. They're afraid of women. The power of the voice of women frightens them. They think that God is a tiny little conservative being who would send girls to hell just because of going to school. The terrorists are misusing the name of Islam and push past in society for their own personal benefits. Islam is a religion of peace, humanity, and brotherhood. Islam says that it is not only each child's right to get education, rather it is their duty and responsibility.
Wow. What a remarkable thing. And said during Ramadan, even. You know.
Yes, and there is a Stand With Malala petition calling for education for the 57 million children around the world who don't go to school, and it's already got 4 million signatures.
That's marvelous.
I thought we'd start with some good news.
Yeah. Is there a website or anything for this that we can push people to, point people to?
I don't know, but my Guardian article has Stand With Malala petition underlined.
Uh-huh.
I'm guessing that if you Google Stand With Malala petition, it will take you somewhere.
And how do you spell her name?
M-A-L-A-L-A.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And what else?
Eric Holder, the Attorney General, has met with the President earlier today and presented his report on what to do about how the FBI and investigators deal with going after the phone records and emails of journalists in investigations and the new guidelines.
Hmm.
And the report is now out. Well, the new guidelines would take effect almost immediately, and the big changes are interesting. They would prevent the FBI from portraying a reporter as a co-conspirator in a criminal leak as a way to get around a legal bar on secret search warrants for reporting materials.
So, in other words, they're reversing what happened to James, was it Rosen?
Precisely.
Fox News thing. Okay, that's good news, I would think.
That's good news. They would also make it harder, but not impossible, but harder for prosecutors to get a journalist's calling records from phone companies without giving news organizations advance notice, which is what happened to the AP.
Right. Now, are these changes in the rules within an agency, these simply become the new rules, right? They don't require any legislative action?
Right. These are the new rules. Now, there is a media shield law that is being proposed. In some respects, there are things in the new guidelines that go further than the media shield law rules. For example, the guidelines explicitly require advance notice by default unless there's a specific finding that there are compelling reasons that doing so would pose a threat to the integrity of the investigation to move forward on something.
Right.
And if they are going to delay notice of moving forward, they can only delay it for 45 or 90 days. Well, under previous rules, they could put it off indefinitely. And the media shield law, my understanding is, actually doesn't have a guideline of 45 or 90 days.
Wow. Wow. Remarkable. Victoria,
yeah.
Some good news for the day. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Glad to provide some good news.
In fact, a lot of good news for the day. So pretty much all good news. So always great to hear from Victoria. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes Friday. Anything goes summer, really, but in particular, it's Friday. Malala Day, that's a remarkable story. This young woman who was shot by the Taliban for the crime of going to school while 15 years old, speaking today to the United Nations. It's just the war on women in the United States is real, but it's small compared to the war on women that is going on in much of the third world. And it's really, really something. I'm just very, very impressed by this young woman. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I was wanting to talk about the farm bill that was just passed in the House. People are talking about how the nutritional programs were set aside altogether,
right.
Including SNAP.
Right.
And I just want to say that SNAP is only one nutritional program. There are many, many nutritional programs, Meals on Wheels, school lunches, aid to food banks. All these things are nutritional programs that the House has set aside. The farm bill that we were currently working under was signed in 2008 by George W. Bush, and it was for $604 billion over 10 years. So it's still good till 2018, even if nothing passes. But what people are not talking about is that the House of Representatives, let's say what it was, 70% of that was indeed nutritional programs. So let's understand that all that money works its way back to the big agricultural companies anyway, because you spend money on food, they make money on it, right? But so it was about $420 billion in nutritional programs and $180 billion in out-and-out tax credits and farm subsidies for about a half a dozen big agricultural companies like Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what they've done now, the House set aside all of the nutritional programs, but they raised the subsidies and tax credits to almost $200 billion, about a 10% increase. So what they really want to guarantee, these Republicans, these Tea Partiers who are so fiscally responsible and want to rein in government spending, is they want to guarantee that their buddies in the agricultural business are going to get a raise, a 10% raise. Is anybody else getting a 10% raise?
Mm.
I don't think so. And it's a 10%
CEOs.
Giveaway.
Yeah.
Okay, so a government giveaway. These guys love government giveaways.
Yeah, as long as they're in a big corporation.
Here's the disappointing thing, Tom, that really disappoints me, is the Senate, the democratically controlled Senate, agreed already to cut $4 billion. So what the democratically controlled Senate wants to do is contribute $4 billion to that $20 billion increase that the House wants to give to the big agricultural companies anyway.
Yeah.
You see, this is just a bunch of baloney. So what we really need to do, we'd be better off if just nothing happened. And by the way, the reason that we have a farm bill that was operating from 2008 is because the Congress has not passed a budget since President Obama has been in office.
Right.
The first 2 years that it was a democratically controlled Congress, all of the budgets that the Democrats passed were filibustered.
Right.
And since then, since the 112th and 113th Congress, of course, we've had the Tea Partiers in control.
Right. So the Senate actually did pass a budget this year, but John Boehner and Eric Cantor will not bring it to the floor of the House for a vote.
Okay, yeah, okay. It hasn't gone to the president's desk, right?
Right, right, because it has not gone through the House of Representatives. Paul, thank you for all the information. You've filled in a lot of gray areas for me on the Farm Bill. I appreciate it. Excellent points. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just did a quick bit of math on the Koch brothers, $34,000, world population, 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that there are 1,426 billionaires in the world. There's 7.097 trillion people. Turns out that the billionaires make up 20 millionths of 1% of the world population. Now, a little corollary to that, millionaires make up 0.169 of 1%. And they control 39% of the world's wealth. So,
wow.
Little disparity here. Play numbers, Koch brothers, but it doesn't change a thing.
Wow.
That's it.
But the main thing is they want us all to know. Do you have that? Do you have that clip readily available, Jim, or Shano, either one of you? The Koch brothers want you to know that if you're making, By assumption, even if you're making $10,000 or $15,000, you're doing really, really well. Because here's what Charles Koch. Actually, I shouldn't say the Koch brothers. This is Charles Koch Foundation. This is Charles Koch's ad. Here it is.
Are you in the 1%? Well, if you earn over $34,000 a year, you are one of the wealthiest 1% in the world.
There you go.
Is the power of economic freedom.
Yes, indeed. The economic freedom for billionaires to stomp all over all of us. Bill, thank you for calling and sharing the numbers, the real math. Ron, in Windham, New York. Hey, Ron, what's up? Ron? You are on the air, Ron.
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ron. I dropped you just as you started to speak. Try calling right back. There is an open line. There is one. Linda, it's the one you were on, in Salem Pass. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have a scam alert and a couple of questions that regarding it. Another friend of mine yesterday received a mailing from the Senior Center, which is part of the Checks and Balances for Economic Growth. This is a 501c4 organization.
Okay.
Now, this mailing is targeting seniors, and they're saying that politicians in Washington are stealing billions from the Social Security Trust Fund and replacing it with worthless IOUs. They want you to also sign a petition to Rand Paul in support of passage of legislation such as the Social Security Preservation Act. They also want you to send some money, which is not tax deductible. Well, I got on the internet to try to research this organization and come to find out that they have run ads in Ohio before the 2012 elections against Sherrod Brown and Barack Obama on behalf of the Murray Cole Company. They also, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington has filed a complaint with the FEC to investigate this group because they're not supposed to be, since they're a 501c or C4 organization, they're not supposed to be involved in politics. So, but I just wanted people to know that if they get one of these mailings, you know, they're targeting seniors, so it could be your parents or whatever, please do not contribute to them. Also, I'm planning on writing a letter and using their postage paid envelope to do so. But I have a couple of questions. I know I have friends, too, that think that the Social Security Trust Fund is being ripped off by the government. And I'd right. like to know how that got started. Also, can the IRS reject or, you know, cancel their 501c status?
Okay, with regard to this group, the IRS can, and if they get enough protests from people, they may reconsider something. They may reconsider their tax-exempt status. So, you know, it's something to contact the IRS about. The other question, I'm sorry.
That the government's ripping off the
How did that get started?
Social Security Trust Fund. I'd like to know the background on that.
Okay, here's the story. The Social Security Trust Fund has $2.7 trillion. They want to invest that in some place where it makes a return on the investment. They don't want to go to Wall Street and buy General Electric stock. So what they do is they buy U.S. Treasuries. Now, if you buy U.S. Treasuries, what you are doing is you are buying U.S. debt. And it's very safe. It's very secure. And it produces a return of around, you know, 1.5%, 2%, whatever. But you are basically loaning money to the federal government. The federal government then takes that money and spends it because we're operating in a deficit mode. So technically, the government is spending the money that the Social Security Trust Fund has given them. But actually, it's a liability. When the Social Security Trust Fund comes and says, let me redeem this Treasury bill, just like when the Bush family does, the government gives them back their money. So hang on just a second, Linda.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So basically, it is a lie that the government is taking the Social Security Trust Fund and spending it. It is a very slick and clever lie, but it's a way of making you not trust Social Security. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Patricia, you wanted to share some thoughts on the Zimmerman trial from a different perspective?
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Sure. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air. I hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. This is strictly from my point of view, which is extremely analytical.
Okay.
The one thing that struck me, I've been watching this bookend to bookend too, and the one thing that struck me throughout is the fact that it seems to be written in stone that George Zimmerman is Caucasian. Agreed?
Not so much. I mean, he looks relatively Hispanic. He presents himself as a Hispanic. I believe that one of his parents is Hispanic and one is Caucasian, but I could be wrong on that. I'm not a George Zimmerman expert.
Right, which leads me to my second point.
Right.
I believe that partially what what really mitigated this whole thing was the fact that he was not taken for Caucasian, probably in his early life. And due to that fact, he was probably bullied some, depending on where he grew up. Then he went to try to become a policeman for whatever reasons, which I never got quite clear why they refused him, but they did.
Right.
So he took the next best alternative, which was to go into this neighborhood watch thing. And I think basically what motivated him was really acceptance, trying to be accepted by the basically Caucasian hierarchy.
Yeah, this is, let's keep in mind, this was a wealthy, gated community.
Well, I guess then the fact that he happened to be there at that particular time and saw this kid was something that made him follow him to find out what he was doing and so forth. Rather than, this is one other little point, rather than take the empathetical avenue of having been bullied and not fitting into the exact Caucasian hierarchy, he took the other way. He took the other way, which was to take this young man or any young man that he found in the same circumstance and basically wipe him out so that he could then be looked upon by the hierarchy as a hero.
Yeah. So you're saying George Zimmerman felt dismissed in his life, and so he was trying to elevate himself in this. I would say a middle ground, if we all want to play amateur shrink on this, would be, he was just asserting power because he felt powerless, and not
right.
necessarily that he
exactly.
was doing it to get approval. But none of us really can know what's inside his heart or his head, Patricia.
But nobody has ever gone into, nobody's ever talked very much about his life in any aspect.
Yeah.
And to me, that leaves a big vacant hole.
Well, it does for those of us who are curious about such things. But at law, unless he's making a defense that he's mentally ill, it really doesn't matter, what kind of life he had, where he came from, what his motivations
were. I honestly believe maybe that would have been a better defense because as far as I'm concerned, he's guilty of murder.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think so.
That's it, and I really thank you for the time.
Sure. Thanks for the call, Patricia. Great, great comment. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a question about these corporate people, these newly born people who were corporations. How does the tax code apply to them? And if they're domiciled out of the United States, are they legal here? And how does that all work?
Yes. A foreign corporation, according to the United States Supreme Court, has the same personhood status in the United States as a U.S. corporation. They may have different restrictions and different tax regulations and things like that, much as a foreign citizen has a personhood status in the United States under the Constitution, the same as a U.S. citizen. In other words, somebody from France who's in the United States under our Constitution has the Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate themselves, just as you or I do as a citizen. The Constitution does not say we the citizens of the United States; it's we the people. Throughout the Constitution, it refers to people and persons; it does not refer to citizens. So if we're establishing personhood for human beings and we've decided to extend that to corporations, that extension to corporations extends to foreign as well as domestic corporations. And it gets particularly fuzzy because a corporation can be owned by more than one entity. And so you've got a lot of American corporations, particularly if they're traded on an international stock exchange or an internationally available stock exchange like the New York Stock Exchange, who could be, owned 5% or 50% or 90% by foreign owners, and yet they're considered American corporations because they're principally domiciled here in the United States. So it gets really messy, and it's another example of why the whole Supreme Court idea of giving corporations personhood rights under the Constitution is so absurd. With regard to tax law, corporations have a whole different set of tax laws than human beings do, which again demonstrates the absurdity of the Supreme Court saying that they should have rights under the Constitution the same as you and I do, because they're not treated the same way under IRS code or tax code. And you know, there's a whole different set of laws. For example, if you were to, at the end of the year, say to the IRS that you wanted, say your income was $40,000 last year and you spent $10,000 on meals, and you sent a letter to the IRS saying, my income was only $30,000 because I bought food for $10,000, they will laugh at you. But if a corporation says our employees, you know, went out to lunch and you know, did business over lunch and spent $10,000, then that's $10,000 that's deducted from the gross income of the corporation for tax purposes. They don't have to pay taxes on that. So there's a whole different set of tax laws for corporations than there are for human beings. And that's basically how it works. Michelle, thanks for calling and thanks for asking the question. I think the point that you're trying to make, and I think that I just illustrated, is that the Supreme Court is just plain old fat guano crazy. I mean, you know, having come up with this doctrine, which no Congress has ever endorsed or even suggested, that corporations are people and money is speech. It's nuts.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And when it was first pushed in a big way in the 1880s by the Supreme Court, it was being pushed principally by Stephen Jay Field, who was a corrupt Supreme Court justice who'd been bought off by the railroads. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Indeed. Deidre in Congress, Arizona. Hey, Deidre, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'm finally glad to talk to you today.
Thank you.
I heard the man call in around the farm bill and what they had put in, $195.6 billion into that. Plus, they made it in perpetuity. Can you do that to a bill?
You can appropriate money forever, yes, as, you know, with the single exception of the defense budget. The Constitution,
yeah, 2 years.
Limits defense appropriations to 2 years, but there are no limits on any other appropriations. I don't know for a fact that it's in perpetuity. The caller asserted that. I can't back that up, but, you know.
Yeah, I think, well, some nights try to watch Chris Hayes, Rachel Maddow, and Lawrence O'Donnell. You learn a lot from there, but I double-check it before I do anything.
Yep.
You know, I listen kind of with a grain of salt. But well, pretty much everything they say has come true.
Yeah, I think generally, and it's the same thing, you know, if I'm doing a riff on a topic here or on our TV show, I will have researched it, and I will stand behind what I say. But just because somebody calls into a show and Paul is a regular caller, and to the best of my knowledge, he's always been spot on with his facts. But still, just because somebody calls into a talk show, it's just like somebody, you see something posted on a blog on the internet, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's factual. So, like you said, Deidre, it's a good point. Do your homework. Thank you for the call. Peter. Hey, Peter, what's up? Peter, you want to suggest that the Depression is wrongly blamed on Herbert Hoover? Really? No, Peter. Okay. I don't have a name here. The criminal defense lawyer regarding affirmative defense. What's your name?
Lance.
Hey, Les, you said?
Hey, Lance, L-A-N-C-E.
Oh, Lance. Okay, Lance, you are on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, first of all, a long-time listener, first-time caller, and it's a real honor.
Thank you,
Lance. To be able to speak with you. You know more, you got more knowledge in your little finger than I do, and I just really admire you.
Well, thank you.
Just need to go back and touch on the earlier caller's comment about an affirmative defense.
Right.
Now, I'd be astounded if Florida law were any different from this.
Okay.
I'm not aware of any jurisdiction that considers the criminal defendant to have any burden of proof at any time in a criminal case. An affirmative defense means that indeed, the defendant is, especially in a situation where self-defense is being asserted. He's saying, I did it. I committed the crime, but I was defending myself. At that point, the burden of proof shifts to the prosecution in somewhat of a different way. It's not so much actually that it shifts, but it's the prosecution's job at that point to disprove the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, so here's, let me just share with you two paragraphs. Each one is the first is two sentences, the second is four, that are, you can find these over at findlaw.com. These are both from 2000, first is from Mosensky's versus the state of Florida, 2010. These are both the Florida. Yeah, what would the court be? The Court of Appeals. And the second one is Montijo v. State. The first says the defendant has the burden of presenting sufficient evidence that he acted in self-defense in order to be entitled to a jury instruction on the issue. But the presentation of such evidence does not change the elements of the offense at issue. Rather, it merely requires the state to present evidence that establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense. That's the Mosansky case in 2010. And then the Montijo case in 2011 said the answer is this. No, he did not have to prove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. He did not have to prove even that his additional facts were more likely true than not. The real nature of his burden concerning his defense of justification is that his evidence of additional facts need merely leave the jury with a reasonable doubt about whether he was justified in using deadly force. Hence, if he wanted his self-defense to be considered, it was necessary to present evidence that his justification might be true. It would then be up to the jury to decide whether his evidence produced a reasonable doubt about his claim of self-defense. So if I'm reading this right, it's basically that it first had to pass through the filter of the judge and the prosecution that he's making an affirmative self-defense argument, and they're accepting that as a legitimate defense. And then once that is done, then the jury has to consider that in the context of the larger offense itself of the alleged second-degree murder. Do I have that right?
The first tube, actually, Tom, is the judge's responsibility to determine, based upon the evidence that has been presented, is there enough evidence of self-defense to allow that issue to go to the jury?
Right. Okay. And in this case, the judge did decide that because that was included in the jury instructions.
Absolutely. She has determined that, yes, enough evidence has been introduced to allow the jury to consider self-defense.
Right.
However, and you read it, the first case that you read laid it out very nicely. At that point, it becomes the prosecution's burden to disprove self-defense, the viability of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. So basically, the prosecution has two burdens. The first is to prove that a crime was committed by this person under these circumstances, and the second is to disprove the self-defense or to prove that there was no legitimate claim of self-defense.
Precisely, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
It's the same burden.
Right.
Right. That's why it's called an affirmative defense.
It's
you are saying I committed the crime.
Yes.
Okay. You're affirming.
I affirm I committed the crime, but here's why.
That's right. And then it shifts to the state to say, okay, now we have to disprove what you're saying.
Right.
To this jury, beyond a reasonable doubt. Show the jury, hey. You know, beyond a reasonable doubt, we can show you this guy was not acting in self-defense.
Right. So here's the original caller who brought this up was asking the question, why have I not heard any discussion of this point of law in any of the commentaries on television? And frankly, I haven't heard this conversation anywhere before on my own show here today. Is that A, because I've only watched maybe an hour a day of what's going on with the trial, and mostly that has been summary shows, you know, or B, because TV has decided, you know, most of the TV producers have decided that that's sufficiently wonky that it'll confuse people, it'll lose their viewers, and they're trying to dumb it down.
My guess is it's probably the latter. I have to tell you, Tom, I've not been terribly impressed with the legal analysis, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It's been provided by various, you know, talking heads, if you will, on this trial. I think there's some misinformation actually out there about the law,
right,
and how it applies to this particular case, the mechanics of this case. But I think it's true. I think that if you try to explain the mechanism of an affirmative defense and how that has to play out,
right,
as far as the burdens, you know, what has to be happening beyond a reasonable doubt, et cetera.
Right.
I think non-lawyers' eyes probably glaze over and they get very confused.
Yeah, well, it essentially contains a double negative, and you know, which is that you have to disprove the self-defense argument.
Right.
You know, the thing that's put forward to say yes, I did, but I didn't, has to be disproven to say, yes, he did, and he didn't, not didn't. Am I making, you know what I'm saying?
Not only did he commit the crime, but if you look, ladies and gentlemen, at what he says about defending himself, that fails as well.
That's right. Now, what's your sense? I'm curious, Lance, I'm assuming you're an attorney.
I am.
Yeah. So you've been apparently watching this case. What's your sense of how the jury's going to rule on this, and what was your take on the quality of both the prosecution and the defense?
Well, I think the prosecution did a pretty good job overall. No trial is perfect. I mean, let's face it.
Sure.
It's a very fluid situation. Lawyers cannot predict with any sort of, precision what is actually how the trial is going to play out.
Right.
It's a very human experience. It's very fluid. Everything depends in large part on what the judge says you will and will not do. And lawyers have to be able to instantly respond to that.
Right.
Just on their feet. If the judge gives a ruling they're not expecting, oh, my gosh, what do we do now? I did that to a prosecutor in a trial several months ago. Caught him so off guard, he literally stood there dumbfounded and looked at the judge and said, Judge, I think I need a recess.
Yeah.
I've got to figure out what to do now.
Amazing. Now, isn't that sort of what happened when the prosecution was doing their summary and the defense jumped up and said, wait a minute, we want a bench discussion, whatever it's called, and it kind of blew up the prosecution's summary?
Yes, and that's very unusual.
I was astounded by that.
Closing argument? Yeah, I mean, it's, for the other side to stand up and start objecting and to have a bench conference during a closing argument, that's very unusual.
So did the defense get away with something really outrageous and harm the prosecution's ability to make a good, continuous, holding a steady emotional tone, prosecution summary?
You and I will never know that because we will never know what was said and done during that bench conference.
Well, it certainly appeared to me that what was said during the bench conference was that the defense was saying this prosecutor is asserting, how the you, judge, are going to describe the law, and that's your job, not the prosecutor's job. And she essentially agreed with that because she came back and she said, okay, I'm going to tell you. I'm the one who's going to tell you what the law is.
Okay, well, and that's probably true. I think the judge went overboard a bit in that.
Yeah.
Because lawyers have wide latitude in discussing the law.
Right, and by being super deferential, she also diminished the possibility of them using that as the basis for appeal, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. Lance, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. It's super having the smartest listeners
on
earth.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, Shano says we should make you a regular guest, Lance. Thanks for the analysis. We'll be right back. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writers and researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at our syndicators, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to all the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, and to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is genuinely appreciated. Jerry. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to ask you, I've been in the stock market since the 90s, and I went through the crash of 2000, and I went through 2008, and my portfolio is worth a third of what it was in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 63 now. I'm just wondering whether I should get back in the market. I trust what you say. I read your books. I really liked Unequal Protection, and I think you're an honest person. Can you give me some advice, or what would you? Are you in the market? Should I get back in mutual funds? The money sits there; it doesn't draw any interest or anything. Can you also answer me? What happened? Why don't we draw interest anymore? How did they ruin our? What happened?
Well, the low interest rates that, you know, the interest rates are basically set by the Fed. And they move our interest rates in order to do two things, or at least the two things are established by the law that created the Fed. One is to control inflation, and the other, which is by heating up or cooling down the economy. You know, low interest rates heat it up, high interest rates cool it down. And the second is to maintain a low level of unemployment. And they're supposed to give equal weight to both, although since the Greenspan years, the Fed has been far more focused on inflation than on employment. Number one. Number two, with regard to investment, I'm not the guy to ask, Jerry. I have made some really dumb investments over the years. I don't, and I'm not a big investor. I don't have a lot of money, and I don't have a lot of money in anything. I own a little bit of a treasury, TLT is what it is. It's a treasury, you know, bond, mutual fund. And, most of the money that Louise and I have that is our, you know, set aside for retirement, which is not in a 401k, we don't have one, is all in cash right now, in money market funds and cash vehicles, because I just don't trust this market. And I know that I have missed out on a market that, you know, went up substantially. And but I just don't trust this market. Now, but let me give you a huge caveat here. I'm really good when it comes to things like macroeconomics. I can give you a good, solid, and probably, you know, pretty unassailable analysis of how and why the economy has done much of what it has done over the last 100 years. I have no idea what it's going to do over the next year or two or three, other than to say, and I'm, this is very clear to me, and I have a book coming out this fall about this, that the fundamentals are broken. The fundamentals have been broken since the late 90s, particularly with Glass-Steagall being blown up by the Gramm-Leach-Bliley bill, and with the creation of a black market in collateralized debt obligations and other types of derivatives that was created. Both of these were the work of Phil Gramm. His wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, and these were both things that Ken Lay wanted. And with the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, they basically gave banksters and Enron and anybody else who wanted to do it the ability to create derivatives, bets on pretty much anything, and trade them as if they were commodities outside of regulated commodity markets. And so we've gone from having in the late 90s nothing in these markets that are unregulated, in these unregulated gray markets, nothing, to having over $900 trillion worth of these kinds of financial instruments. And keep in mind, the world GDP is only $65 trillion a year. $900 trillion worth of them at the time of the crash in 2008, and over $600 trillion of them, according to the Bank of International Settlements, right now as we speak. The large banks in the United States are actively gambling in these things, and they're gambling to the tune of tens and, in some cases, hundreds of trillions of dollars, wildly exceeding the asset basis of any of these large banks, which is why I think that, you know, anybody who has anything more than the amount of money that the FDIC insures in any bank right now, any of the large banks, is making a big mistake. And you know, it's much safer to put money in local community banks or credit unions. Thank you, Shana. But that's, you know, so what I'm looking at is a system that's badly broken, that is run by the banksters. We've gone from, you know, 35% of our economy being manufacturing based to now it's only 11% manufacturing, from the financial industry being 8% of our economy pre-Reagan to now it being over almost 40% of our economy. Some people suggest it's over 40%. This is an economy which is unsustainable. And I believe that in the next couple of years, and I'm predicting 2016, because what I've seen is that administrations tend to hold these things off until the next presidential election. So I'm guessing toward the end of 2016 or early 2017 that there's going to be a big crash. I don't think that the crash of 2008 ever resolved itself. I think we got halfway into it and they stopped the momentum of it, but it hasn't. We haven't fixed things. So that's my take on it, Jerry. For what it's worth. But like I said, don't take investment advice from me. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up Monday, we'll have all the news and information from the weekend, including the latest on the Zimmerman trial, verdict or no verdict. Plus, I'll have a rumble on Monday with the Discovery Institute's Dr. Steve Mayer, author of the new book Darwin's Doubt on Intelligent Design versus Evolution. Most importantly, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Get out there, show up, occupy something, tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you and see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.